Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This morning, a narrowly divided Supreme Court sided with white firefighters and against the city of New Haven, Connecticut, and not incidentally against Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor, ruling that the white firefighters were unfairly denied promotions. Within minutes, the Republican National Committee sent out a mass email pointing out that the Supreme Court has now overturned seven decisions from nominee Sotomayor. But Senator Patrick Leahy, the Democratic chair of the Judiciary Committee that will hear her nomination, called the high court decision wrong. Sotomayor, you'll remember, was on a three-member appeals court, which said that New Haven rightly threw out a promotions exam on which black and Hispanic firefighters scored poorly. The city said they feared the test would leave them vulnerable to lawsuits from minorities, but ultimately, they were sued by the white firefighters who'd done well. Lyle Denniston writes for SCOTUSblog.com. Lyle, we have another 5-4 ruling from this high court. This time, Justice Kennedy wrote the majority opinion. What did he say?
Well, he said essentially that the city of New Haven, by throwing out these test results on the premise that it was trying to avoid being sued because the test results were favorable mostly to white firefighters and not therefore to minority firefighters. And so the city claimed it could not go forward with the promotions because it faced the risk of a lawsuit. Today the court said the test used was a valid test, that the city of New Haven was wrong in thinking otherwise. The court also said that the city cannot claim that it will be sued just as a premise for not going forward with the promotions. In other words, the city has to take the risk of a lawsuit, put the promotions into effect that are the product of this test, and then await a lawsuit claiming that by giving promotions primarily to whites, it is discriminated against minority firefighters. The court did also say, though, that when the city is sued, it can come back and say that it had a real basis for believing that it would be sued and therefore try to get the suit dismissed.
So the Supreme Court, in effect, ruled that the city should have let itself be sued. And under the Civil Rights Act, there is a provision which says there can't be more of a negative impact on a protected class than other groups in things like promotion tests. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg dissented from that majority opinion. What did she write?
Justice Ginsburg protested very strongly. In fact, she read from her opinion dissenting from the bench, which is somewhat unusual for her. But what she said essentially was that the majority had created a new and indefinite kind of standard for judging when an employer can try to avoid a lawsuit by refusing to carry out the results of a test when it thinks the test is skewed against minority employees, whether it's firefighters or Teamsters or anybody else. So she is saying that the majority has narrowed the scope of the basic civil rights law for equality in the workplace in a way that doesn't square with what the court had done in the past.
Well, tell us a little more about that. As we mentioned, this is the Civil Rights Act provision that says there can't be more of a negative impact on one class, a protected class, than another. We understand that Justice Scalia wrote a separate opinion raising the question of whether this disparate impact provision is constitutional. Ruth Bader Ginsburg seemed to be saying that the court narrowed the way cities can use that provision, but what is Scalia saying about it?
Well, let me sort this out for you just a little bit, and perhaps I hope to make this plain. Normally, a government cannot be sued for discrimination under the Constitution unless it intentionally discriminates. However, under the basic civil rights law, in this case Title VII, an employer can be sued if the result of an action it takes towards its employees results in a more negative impact, that is, a disparate impact on minorities than on white workers.
It sounds as if the court is saying you have to go ahead and be sued and then take it up.
I think that's the import of it, is that the court is saying that a lawsuit, a fear of a lawsuit by itself, is not enough to forgive you if you refuse to implement the results of a test.
But it sounds as if Justice Scalia is saying that he doesn't even think that provision, that tests can't be skewed against protected groups, He's writing that that shouldn't even be constitutional.
Well, but it's worth noting here, Robin, that Scalia wrote only for himself. There are not five votes on this court, even after Judge Sotomayor joins it. We're presuming that she will. There are not five votes to overturn a basic civil rights law.
So what, in your view, Lyle Denniston, does today's ruling mean going forward for other cities and towns?
Well, I think what it definitely means is that cities have got to be much more careful in evaluating tests before they give those tests, and it means that if the test is validated as job related and not skewed in a cultural or social way, that they've got to go forward and make the appointments or the promotions or whatever is involved as a consequence of those tests. Even if they fear that that they're going to get sued, I think what it does, it makes it generally much more likely that reverse discrimination lawsuits, that is, claims by white employees, are going to succeed more often, and that employers are therefore going to have to fight harder to win when the minority workers turn around and sue, claiming that they have now been discriminated against.
Lyle Denniston of SCOTUSblog.com commenting on today's Supreme Court decision, siding with white firefighters against the city of New Haven, Connecticut, in their decision. Lyle, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Glad to be with you, Robin.
Motorcycles are banned in the streets of Baghdad today after they were used in three separate bomb attacks that killed at least 100 people last week. A total of 250 people have been killed. In the run-up to tomorrow's deadline for American troops to leave Iraqi cities and towns and pull back to outlying bases. In a moment, we'll speak with military analyst Khalif Sepp. But first, a view from Iraq. Joining us from the Forward Operating Base, or FOB, Warhorse in Diyala Province is Tom Peter of the Christian Science Monitor. Tom, what's the mood there as the deadline approaches?
Well, it's certainly a day that a lot of people have been waiting for, and now that it's arrived, you know, the people are meeting with a lot of tentative emotions and a lot of excitement. I believe the day has been declared a national holiday, but at the same time, there's a lot of people that have some pretty big questions, certainly whether the Iraqi security forces, which includes, you know, the military and the police, will they be able to provide security and hold on to the gains that have been made over the last year or two? And additionally, is the government going to really be able to step up and operate and function without corruption and be able to deliver a lot of these civil services like regular electricity and clean water that have been missing for so long out here?
Well, what are you hearing from Iraqis about how they feel about U.S. troops leaving the cities? Are they eager for them to go or nervous about Iraqi troops' readiness to take over?
Well, you know, one of the things that I've spent some time out here doing is going out with the U.S. troops as they're kind of trying to do what they call atmospherics, trying to gauge what the Iraqi population is thinking about this and how they're going to react. And one of the things that you, if you look at like kind of the city centers, those are the places where people tend to be the most eager, in particular in marketplaces where the U.S. patrols will come through, and it has a negative effect on business because people feel maybe a little uncomfortable. Maybe they think that there's going to be a major operation and then they should leave the area. So it does hurt businessmen in that sense. But even there, you're going to find people saying, well, we don't want you coming through our markets or in the center of our town, but we'd still like you in the outskirts in case something happens. Then when you kind of move a little further out onto the fringe, you're dealing with locals who are a little more cut off. I mean, we don't have as many military or police patrols coming through their neighborhoods. They probably have a more difficult time getting central services like, you know, electricity and water. And that's where you find people with a lot more kind of conflicted feelings. There are very big question marks for them about, will the Iraqi security forces be able to fill that void? And the Iraqi military really does have a lot to prove itself to the people, because it has made some huge bounds, but it still has a very bad image with a lot of the locals. For me, what stands out the most is, you know, in 2006 when I was out here, there was a huge problem with death squads coming into villages, and they would be in Iraqi military uniforms and in some cases even using, you know, official Iraqi military vehicles. Whether or not these had been stolen or or these were official Iraqi, you know, military guys doing this stuff, it wasn't clear.
Right.
But that image is still just, you know, burned into a lot of people's minds. So the Iraqi military really has to work hard to overcome this negative image that it has. So even though it has made improvements, really I think the most important thing for the Iraqi military and the Iraqi police in particular, who have a very bad reputation in some parts, is really going to have to be to build up their image and prove to the Iraqi people, we have improved, we are a new organization, and we are going to pick up the torch and really take care of you guys and provide the security that we need to move forward.
Have there been some friendships forged? I'm just wondering on that level how Iraqis feel.
Yeah, well, especially you find between the soldiers, the American soldiers and the Iraqi soldiers, in particular, that's where you're going to find the closest relationship, just because it's a working relationship. What I found really interesting is that when I'm at a lot of these meetings between the U.S. soldiers and their Iraqi counterparts, what's quite interesting is that, you know, now the U.S., to go into the cities, it has to have an invitation or from Iraqi authorities. And a lot of the Iraqi authorities now, or the Iraqi soldiers, are saying to the U.S. soldiers, you know, please just come back here for social visits and once you're completely out of the cities, to the point where it almost makes the Americans a little uncomfortable. And they're saying, well, you know, you're going to have to check with our commanders and whatnot. But they certainly are hoping to, it seems at least, you know, that they want to maintain some of the relationships that they've built.
And Tom, just is there anything, you know, just a brief quick thought on this. Here in the U.S., between Iran recently in the headlines, North Korea, you could throw in Michael Jackson. I think many Americans are going to be stunned to realize that this deadline is tomorrow. Are people there feeling that sort of disconnect from Americans, that this momentous day is happening, but a lot of Americans haven't been following this?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned the Michael Jackson, because, you know, that was, of course, big news. It was running on all the televisions when it happened, and you know, one soldier out here was talking about how frustrating it was that there's all of this stuff that's happening in the world, you know, the June 30th deadline out here, the revolution that seems to be happening in Iran, and you know, back at home, Michael Jackson is what's dominating the news coverage. You know, it's hard to stomach for a lot of guys out here that, you know, the American public has kind of moved on from the story and from the war in many regards.
That's Christian Science Monitor correspondent Tom Peter speaking to us from Forward Operating Base Warhorse outside of Bakuba in Diyala province in Iraq, ahead of tomorrow's deadline for U.S. troops to pull out of Iraqi cities. Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, when we come back, can Iraqis regain trust in their forces, in each other? We'll speak with military analyst Khalaf Sepp. Also, as Bernie Madoff heads to prison for 150 years, an economics professor teaches a course that asks students to think about whether owning lots of things makes them happy. That's later. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. Before the break, we heard from Iraq about what people on the ground there think about American forces pulling back from Iraqi cities and towns by tomorrow. The June 30th deadline was forged in the Status of Forces Agreement made with Iraq in late 2008. It lays out a timeline for U.S. troop withdrawal from the country. Joining us on the line now from Monterey, California, retired Army Colonel, Lieutenant Colonel Khalaf Sepp. He's a defense analyst at the Naval Postgraduate School there. Dr. Sepp, welcome back to Here and Now.
Hello, Robin.
Well, and what do you think? We just heard before the break that there is sort of an unanswered question. Some people a little leery about Iraqi military forces being ready to take over. Your thoughts?
Well, part of what your reporter Tom Peters was talking about that I think is actually a very positive indicator is that this has not been very high-profile issue in the news, that, you know, over 150 U.S. military bases have already been turned over to the Iraqis. It's been done so smoothly and so successfully to this point that it hasn't been strikingly newsworthy.
Well, for a couple of things. First of all, you say so smoothly, but in the last couple of weeks, we saw several suicide bombs, hundreds of people killed. Is that because of the pullout?
Almost certainly it is. But even though it's there have been these horrific spikes in violence, if you average it out over the month of June, it's not really more remarkable than it has been in preceding months. You know, all casualties are bad. But if you compare it to a year ago, violence is still down almost 90%.
Well, General Odierno, the U.S. commander in Iraq, said that these spikes in violence are groups trying to gain attention. We've heard from other analysts that these are the last gasps of al-Qaeda in Iraq. The U.S. military feels that that insurgent group has dwindled from thousands of members to hundreds. But a couple questions there. If, in fact, these were insurgent groups that wanted to sort of strike at vulnerable places with the U.S. troops pulling out, wouldn't they wait? And does this mean that in a couple of weeks we might see a huge spike in violence because they know that the U.S. troops aren't in the cities?
This is exactly the kind of discussions that the violent extremist groups themselves would be having about, do we lay low and wait for an opportunity to present itself later on, or do we strike now? And this is really the better time for them, and not all of them would act in conjunction with each other anyway. But this is the time when there's actually the most vulnerability for the Iraqi government and for the U.S. military, as the Americans are disengaging and the Iraqi security forces are taking over, and there's a transition of responsibility. And this is actually a very, very complex military operation. And this would be a time for these groups to test the capacity and capabilities of the Iraqi security force.
Well, would it be to test their skills or to test their organization or all of the above? In other words,
all of those things. It's ultimately it's to test the Maliki government itself, because Prime Minister Maliki has bet everything on this. And if his government can't handle the transition and the new responsibilities, his government is, you know, could be moved to the edge of collapse, and the worst thing that could happen would be that he would have to turn to the Americans and abrogate his own agreement and ask for the Americans to come back and shore him up. But he does not want to do that, and he will take extraordinary steps to make sure that he isn't pushed into that position by the insurgents.
Well, from your research, are the Iraqi troops themselves ready to raise guns, for instance, and point them at other Iraqis, even if they're insurgents?
Well, the Iraqis have been fighting other Iraqis to this point. And, you know, most of it, and some of it's been in the context of the civil war that's part of this this conflict, and against Iraqis who have been, you know, who are recruited into by foreign terrorists like the al-Qaeda in Iraq organization. They're going to have to establish domestic tranquility in some way, and in many cases this will be through use of arms. But it's what they've been prepared to do by their American and allied trainers up to this point. Some Iraqi units and organizations will be more ready than others, but it's, you know, but ultimately at some point it's their country, and they're going to have to fight for it themselves.
So you say some Iraqi forces are ready, some aren't. But what about the trust issue that Tom Peters spoke of, that in the past insurgents have dressed in Iraqi police uniforms and committed atrocities, and in some cases it's been the Iraqi forces. So what about that trust issue?
Well, this is where you're doubtless going to be able to find many Iraqis who, as has already been reported, will say it's better for the Americans to stay. Over the 6 years of this very intense, very difficult war, the Americans have remade themselves into a very, very effective counterinsurgency force. And part of that, of course, is that they appear to the average Iraqi now as being neutral in all of this and apolitical, which is exactly the image that they're supposed to have. Among the Iraqis, the Sunnis are always going to distrust the Shia. Among the Shia, there's going to be different political factions. Businessmen are going to be concerned about corrupt police. The Americans were, had made themselves into a terrific intervention factor in all of that. And with that dampener gone, many Iraqis in different ways will be more at risk. But, you know, as I said before, ultimately it's their country, and they're simply going to have to deal with these issues. issues on their own.
And we should say U.S. troops are no way out of harm's way. They'll still be carrying out operations in rural areas and along the border. You say Mosul, for example, this in the north, may still be too unstable to go it alone. That may be a place where U.S. troops might have to come back?
What would probably happen first is that the Maliki government would draw on its reserves from other parts of the country that are less unstable and send them to Mosul. It would be a terrific embarrassment for the Maliki government, and politically very dangerous if they have to ask the Americans to come back in.
That's retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Khalif Sepp, defense analyst at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. Dr. Sepp, thank you as always.
Thank you, Robin.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, a military coup rocks Honduras. What does that mean for Central America? That's tomorrow. We'll be back after the latest news, including the sentencing of Bernard Madoff. That's next, Here and Now. As we're reporting today, a New York judge sentenced Bernard Madoff to 150 years in prison for securities fraud and other charges. Judith Welling, who lost most of her savings to Madoff's Ponzi scheme, addressed reporters after the sentencing, saying she thought it was fair.
This is a beginning. It's not an end. It's not closure. It's a beginning, maybe, to trying to restore some faith in our financial system.
Well, as Madoff heads back to prison, he becomes part of a striking statistic.
In the next 5 years, one out of four CEOs in the U.S. will be convicted and sent to jail, and the same amount will flee the country in a single-engine plane with gold coins sewn into their underpants.
Wait a minute. That's, of course, not true. That's a fictional jailed CEO in Andy Borowitz's new book, Who Moved My Soap? The CEO's Guide to Surviving in Prison. Andy is, of course, the comedian and New York humorist, but Andy, isn't this a little tasteless? The Madoff family's ruined. He ruined so many other families. Is this too soon?
Well, tasteless is kind of my stock and trade. I mean, you don't really want to put me out of business like that. But no, it's not tasteless. This is a very positive book. You know, the travails of CEOs going to prison is only going to grow over the next few years. And I think there has to be some kind of a self-help guide for these guys.
Well, and there are those who would ask, how tasteful is it to make $50 billion and more of other people's money disappear? So perhaps they put the tasteless in the Madoff column. So here we go. Your character addresses these, as you call them, barbarians at the prison gate and concludes that for Madoff, going to prison really won't be all that bad. Why?
He's really just going to be trading one gated community for another. It's really not that big a difference. And, you know, really, Bernie, I think prison would be a great place for him to set up a new Ponzi scheme. It'll probably involve cigarettes. But I do think that he has a really good chance of getting back in business behind bars.
You say one of the benefits of CEOs going to prison is that they're now away from the prying eyes of the SEC.
Exactly. The narrator of Who Moved My Soap is a guy who ran a company called Shamco, which is a huge telecommunications, pharmaceuticals, energy giant.
I have to jump in and say that he and his partner created this company through complex stock transactions and one very successful bake sale.
Yeah, exactly. They're kind of shady operators. But, you know, the fact is he gets behind bars and he sees lots of opportunities to keep on conning people because, you know, he's surrounded by CEOs in prison. And CEOs are the most gullible, easy marks for a con man because, you know, every time a CEO goes on trial, the first thing he says is, I had absolutely no idea what was going on around me. I was completely oblivious.
And by the way, your CEO lived the high life of the CEOs. He once flew 2,000 of Shamco's senior vice presidents to Capri for drinking, complimentary Botox injections, a hot wings station manned by Queen Elizabeth II.
You know, when you have money, what you find out is that anybody can be bought. Queen Elizabeth will do corporate events if you meet her price.
You go out of your way to describe these unbelievably absurd scenes in prison. And there's one going on in real life that I don't think you could have made up. Have you heard about the bar mitzvah that took place in the tombs in Manhattan?
Mazel tov. Why not? That's a great thing.
Well, apparently the prisoner was in jail on grand larceny, a $1.7 million financial scam, and he hosted 60 guests. There was catering and entertainment. The prison guards worked overtime. This was all on taxpayer dollars. This was in the tombs, the big prison in New York.
And now he is a man. That's fantastic. Good for him.
It was for his son. But I guess I'm saying that, you know, your satire, you have to write it quickly because it soon becomes real.
You know, I was following the whole Mark Sanford thing last week, the governor from South Carolina who was found in Argentina when he said he was hiking the Appalachian Trail. And as much as I try to come up with crazy things to say about this guy, he kept on sort of leapfrogging me and doing something crazier than I could have come up with. So the same is true with Madoff. It's really hard to kind of beat the reality, unfortunately.
Well, just one last word of advice to Bernard Madoff as he heads to prison.
I would stay away from some of these really tough Palm Beach gangs. There's a gang called the Gefilte Kings. They're mean, they're bad, and they are really, really angry at you.
Andy Borowitz, author of Who Moved My Soap? The CEO's Guide to Surviving in Prison, also creator of BorowitzReport.com and a regular humorist for The New Yorker. Andy, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, just ahead, does buying more stuff make you happy? Students are being asked that in 3 seconds here and now. Has the down economy changed your spending habits? According to the Commerce Department, many Americans are starting to save more and spend less. The savings rate rose to more than 6% in May. Now, that may not sound like a lot, considering that in the 1970s, Americans saved around 14% of their income. But in 2005, it was around zero. We weren't saving at all. Well, an economics professor at Amherst College is trying to raise awareness about spending and saving. Daniel Barbazat just finished his first year teaching a new class called Consumption and the Pursuit of Happiness. Professor, we understand that your class focuses on the economic theory behind happiness and satisfaction and how that relates to what we buy and consume. You look at a number of studies and surveys that measure well-being. But what's the overall goal of the class?
The goal of the class is to have students realize that their own consumption is contextual, that what they consume and how they consume are very important to what kind of well-being they derive from that consumption.
Well, you start each class with a contemplative exercise, and this will give us an idea what you're talking about, because one of them is you ask students to close their eyes and picture themselves happy and then also picture themselves satisfied.
Yeah.
I'm going to take 2 seconds and ask people to do that now, right? Can we do that? So we're closing our eyes. We're picturing ourselves happy. And now we're feeling satisfied. Was that it, Professor?
Yeah.
There is a little difference.
And the reason for that is that many of the surveys taken ask those different questions. So the various surveys of well-being, some will ask your level of happiness, some will ask satisfaction. And the data can be quite different. So prior to the students seeing those articles, I wanted them to get a sense of, there might be a difference based on the nature of the question, the ordering of the question, the framing of those questions.
And so when they hit the literature, as you say, they will know the difference between satisfaction and happiness. What is, to you, the difference?
My own sense is that happiness is a temporary thing. So I feel it more localized, I'll say. Satisfaction seems a broader sort of contentment. But that's my own view. Each individual's framing of that, those differences really make a large difference because all of the economics data is based on these kinds of survey questions. And so the manner in which the individuals interpret those questions is essential to understand, you know, the outcomes of those studies.
Well, there's another exercise that illustrates some of what you're talking about. You ask students to imagine that they want to buy a smartphone, some newfangled gadget. Some work to get the phone. Others are given the phone by their moms. What's the difference in your mind, and what did you find?
I asked them that, and then asked, after a month, which of the two appreciates the phone more? And have them reflect on that. And overwhelmingly, the students said the person who worked for it. Now, this is interesting for two reasons. One, in economic models, work is seen as a negative. You work to get income to buy stuff that you want, okay? Right. So immediately, students say, wait a second. Work, my input, what I've done, actually has a positive outcome. I feel good about my agency. I feel strong, independent, and so forth. So it begins them to say, wait a second, work itself might have a benefit to me, the very act of working. That's one aspect. The second aspect is to realize that here are two people, both who want a smartphone, both who are using the smartphone, consuming the smartphone, but the context in which they consume it gives them a different sense of well-being. So this exercise has them see that the nature of consumption is not a mechanical relationship to well-being. It's the framing. So it's not should you consume more or should you consume less. It's about an awareness of how and what you're consuming.
Well, but the example we just gave of the smartphone,
yeah.
The kids who worked for it and purchased it had a better sense of well-being than those who were given it as a gift. But doesn't that then follow that buying things because you've worked and made money to buy them makes you feel better?
You know, I think it could be that. But each of those things, your relationship to them and your consumption of them, it depends on how you conceive them. If you worked a whole lot and just bought a bunch of stuff and didn't use them or weren't appreciative of those things, you wouldn't have such a good well-being. So the students kind of grapple with their own sense of, maybe you come to that conclusion, another student might think, wow, wait a second, the act of consumption is a little more complicated. It depends on the framing. So those reflections, I think, are really, really important because they get the students to start to be self-aware of their own consumption.
Well, Professor Barbazat, we understand you identify yourself as a Buddhist, and this is, after all, Amherst College. A lot of people know it's a very progressive, forward-thinking school. Is this something everybody's talking about? How do we avoid the next Wall Street collapse? We know schools are trying to bring ethics and morality and thinking into their business schools, but is this really something that young people are going to stop to do in their classes?
It's a good question. The students that I taught this semester were very eager to run this experiment. And I think that the articles that we read in academic scholarly journals are very abstract and theoretical. But if I can design contemplative exercises where students can bring their own experience and their own reflection to bear on those theoretical controversies or complexities, I think they get a deeper understanding of them. And I think that is something that we're seeing more and more being used. There is a role for another mode of knowing to bring to an analytic and theoretical understanding of complex issues like this.
Well, we know that the Center for Contemplative Mind and Society helped you design this course. They're working with professors in other fields to bring a contemplative approach to education. But I'm just wondering, how do other economics professors look at you? We are, after all, we almost forgot, we're talking about an economics course.
There's kind of three broad groups. One thinks, oh, that's an interesting experiment. Tell me how it goes when you're done. There's another group who thinks you're a lunatic. And there's another group that thinks, you know, it sounds like a good course. And once you drop this contemplative stuff, it'll be just fine. So, you know, they span the gamut, really.
And do you think you'll continue?
Oh, yeah. I've been very heartened and I've kind of learned a lot in this first iteration. I think students become frustrated when they read very difficult, dense material that they don't see how it fits into the world. And to do that analytic work and yet have them get glimmers of how, wow, this actually impacts my own life, I think really has students bear down a little harder on that difficult kind of work, and they become more interested and more curious.
I understand they become curious, but in taking the time to think, at least one of them thought, I don't like economics.
Yeah, that's right. The student came to realize, I'm very unhappy doing economics and really not that interested. And that's a profound moment, and I was very pleased for him.
Even though he dropped out of your class? Or left your...
He didn't actually drop out of the class, but out of the major. And so what's beautiful about this class is it's not prescriptive. It's about becoming more mindful and clear about what is actually happening. And so I thought that was a great achievement, actually. The student came to realize that, wow, I'm interested in something else. I'm going to pursue that.
That's Daniel Barbazat, an economics professor at Amherst College here in the Massachusetts area. His course is called Consumption and the Pursuit of Happiness. Professor, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Here and Now.
Tonight's the night that the waters rise, y'all groping in the dark. Ticket takers count the men who can afford the ark.
That's the band The Low Anthem, music mostly hushed, played on finger-picked guitars and more than 24 other instruments, lyrics haunted by characters shuffling through a society near collapse. But sometimes this Rhode Island trio cuts loose with a sort of delirious roadhouse ferocity. The Low Anthem is Ben Knox Miller, Jeff Christowski, and Jossie Adams. Their latest self-produced CD has just been released nationally by Nonesuch Records. It's called Oh My God, Charlie Darwin. Here and Now's Alex Ashlock spoke to the band before a recent show at the Brattle Theater here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and asked Ben to describe their sound.
Well, there's a lot of different sounds on the record. It's rather bipolar, and so there's sort of something for everybody to not like. We've had very few reviews where somebody didn't say, you know, this would be a great band if they would just stick to such and such. So the first local review we got was this guy who called the Loud Stuff. He compared it to the shock and awe tactics of the Iraq military campaign. Said we'd dishonored the ghost of Jack Kerouac.
That's what the Tom Waits song.
That's a Kerouac piece that Waits reinterpreted, that we reinterpreted. And it was calling the folk writing sublime and transcendent and the pinnacle of such and such folk movement that I'm not sure if that's true either.
Yeah, I live in New York in 1949. Go across the country without a dangling sign. Lord Santa in the cocoa ball. I found my father in a gambling hall. Yeah, father, father, where you been? Been a world since I was on its end. Don't worry about me. I'm about to die of the piracy.
Jeff and Jossie? Where do you guys, how do you guys describe your music?
I say that it's rooted in the folk songwriting tradition. Talking Woody Guthrie, Hank Williams, Bob Dylan, Leonard Cohen. But the twist that we put on it has to do with our backgrounds and where we're coming from. I studied a lot of old and modern jazz music, and I was an upright bass player. So when Ben and I first started playing music together, there was a lot of experimentation between those genres. And then when Jossie came in, she brought the classical music influence, which I think comes out in the arrangements on this record. She did most of the horn arrangements, and she played vocal harmonies. So I think that diversity background comes out in some of the kind of experimentation within the folk songwriting tradition that you hear.
Left Louisiana on the rail line. Left Louisiana on the rail line. Lost my love before her time. My love before time. On the way to Ohio. On the way to Ohio.
How old are you guys?
Mid-20s.
It's your birthday today.
Happy birthday.
24.
What about you, Ben?
I'm 25.
Jeff?
24.
The thing that I think is so interesting about you guys, and I see this in other young musicians, my son's a musician, you guys all seem to have the influence of all these older musicians and all these older records, and I'm just wondering, where did that come from?
I just remember in high school going to some concerts with my friends, bands that they were excited about, which I won't name, and thinking these guys aren't playing the kind of music that hits me as just an honest, like, expression of who they were. There was too many layers covering up what the sound of that guitar was making. And so I found in the jazz world musicians who were really there to play their instruments, and I thought that that was honest. And I would go to these jazz clubs, you know, with maybe 20 people there, 3 a.m. downstairs in New York City, and I thought, oh, there was where the real music was being made. It turns out that was a small approach. There was a lot of great music being made, but it wasn't happening in the mainstream.
Isn't it wonderful how there's this resurgent of music that really feels personal and handcrafted? It's just, it's amazing to see, and I think listening to music is becoming a much more personal experience. People are doing it with their earbuds on their iPods, and they're doing it on their personal computers looking up new stuff on MySpace. So you don't have this same kind of crowd mentality of like rock and roll and I'm going to play as loud as I can to the biggest crowd and just be bombastic on stage and strut my stuff. Instead, you have people discovering music in a very intimate, private setting.
Set the sails, I feel the winds are stirring. Towards the bright horizon, sail away. Cast your reckless dreams upon our Mayflower. The haven from the world and hurricane. Who could heed the words of Charlie Darwin?
And what about playing these songs live? I've never seen you play live. I've just listened to the record. How do the songs translate into the live performance?
Very well. we change around on the different instruments in order to
do our
come
best
close
to realize
yeah,
the arrangements
on the record.
And give me a catalog of all the different instruments you guys travel with. I can see them, they're up on the stage now, but yeah. Give me a rundown.
Today you have our pump organ.
How old's that pump organ?
We were told that it was in World War I, that it was taken to France, but I think it was just by this crazy lady, Thelma in North Carolina, who was trying to hustle us on eBay. So there's an acoustic guitar. There's this upright bass here. There's drums, kind of a kit that's just been scrapped together piece at a time from people giving us free stuff. Electric guitar, electric bass, E-flat
horn. What's that instrument he's just picking up on the stage? It looks like an accordion, kind of.
That's a harmonium. It's similar to a pump organ, but the bellows are on the back. You pump it with one hand and play with the other. And we just acquired a cello and a fiddle as well.
You must have a big van.
I don't want to talk about that. Right now, it's a pretty hairy situation. An old minivan. The only way to fit the three of us in there is with instruments in laps and all the rest, and we're driving across the country.
One of these days we're going to make a call into a car talk and really do this van justice. It's always breaking down on us.
Fill up your voice but not your mind. While the agents have changed your monopoly.
Members of the band The Low Anthem, Ben Knox Miller, Jeff Pristowski, and Jossie Adams. Their new CD is Oh My God, Charlie Darwin. They spoke with Here and Now's Alex Ashlock. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.